You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, on the Friday News Roundup this week, the latest from the ground in Ukraine, also why U.S. troops are headed back to Somalia, and the return of secret schools for girls in Afghanistan. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the U.S. women's national soccer team will be paid the same as their male counterparts. That's part of the new collective bargaining agreement both the men's and women's teams reached this week with the U.S. Soccer Federation, the sport's national governing body. This follows a $24 million settlement between the Soccer Foundation and the national women's team, which guaranteed equal pay as well as millions of dollars in back payments for players. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this pay gap story with soccer in particular in the United States? What do you think of this new deal? If you're an athlete or a parent of one, what does this decision mean to you? Do you see more visibility for women's sports in the U.S. in general? Do you want to see more of it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen Goff has been covering soccer for the Washington Post for decades, including Major League Soccer and the U.S. women's and men's national teams. He's covered five Women's World Cups and every Men's World Cup since 1994. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how does this deal work? What had to happen to bring this equal pay deal to reality?
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. A lot of ups and downs for the women trying to gain equality on the pay front. And the big sticking point over the years was these World Cup bonuses. You know, the U.S. women would win a World Cup and get a few million dollars to split. A men's team would, you know, maybe go to the round of 16 and get far more money for their performance. And the money came from FIFA, the World Soccer Governing Body, which provides much more prize money to the men than the women because of the revenue they say they generate. So they've come together and amazingly found a solution in which the two teams will pool their World Cup bonuses and split them down the middle. And, you know, nothing like this has happened in world soccer. It's a first, and, you know, the players are hoping this will lead to greater equality around the world.
Is the United States unique in the relative popularity of the women's national team, a very, very successful team that's actually brought a lot of viewers in, I think, even relative to the men's team?
Yeah, they're rock stars. You know, they've done it through their success in World Cups and the Olympics. They've done it through the way they play, the personalities on and off the field. You know, you can name, you know, you could make the argument that the most popular soccer players, American soccer players in this country are the female players. And so, you know, there is a great a following here. And they have driven sports fans, the interest from sports fans over the last 25 years. Here we are now where they will collect more, you know, more money and be equal with the men.
This hasn't necessarily been kind of a happy kumbaya get together on this, though. Can you talk about some of the contentious years in a lot of ways of women calling for this in the sport that led up to this point?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's been very complicated because, you know, the men have had a very different collective bargaining agreement with the U.S. Soccer Federation than the women. The women were on salaries. The men were on, you know, just appearance fees and bonuses, et cetera. That salary will now go away, and they're both on bonuses and appearance fees, et cetera. So they've bridged that gap. Yeah, the women have gone to court multiple times. They've taken the fight into the public spectrum. It's gotten quite ugly at times, and you know, it's been a hard road, and here we are.
Talking to Stephen Goff from the Washington Post, looking at this new agreement in the national soccer program. giving equal pay to the women's and men's national teams, unique in sports around the U.S. and around the world for soccer. You can join in if you have thoughts, reactions. What does this mean to you? Maybe to the young athletes in your family. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stephen, part of the mission of a soccer program in the United States is to sell soccer to Americans. It's grown a lot, obviously, in popularity, a lot of people playing it. How does this fit into maybe a wider goal of bringing soccer onto more TV screens, getting more people into stands for the national team and for local teams?
Right. I mean, the U.S. Soccer Federation is a nonprofit, and their mission is to grow the game and spread the game. You know, this isn't a private corporation that's strictly making decisions based on revenue. So it's, you know, the women pushed the idea, the belief that, you know, they should be treated the same way as the men, and things have improved rapidly. Now, how does this agreement affect the long term? You know, I think it's, you know, in the public eye, people are going to say, hey, you know what? The Federation has done the right thing. The men's program has begun to understand what the women have gone through. And, you know, they're now really one team, one organization. It's always been kind of a separate thing. The men's team, the women's team, the Federation overseeing all of it. You either picked one side or the other, and you know, it just feels like they've come together, you know, and with a 6-year collective bargaining agreement, I think that will reflect well on soccer in this country, and by extension, will help grow the game.
What are you hearing from the players, especially on the women's team themselves, since this agreement came out?
Yeah, I think they're happy with it. I think they're looking forward to the next step. And they've spoken about that publicly, that they want to push FIFA, the world governing body, to follow suit, and for other countries to follow suit. You know, soccer federations around the world have been very slow to back their women's program and back their women's players. So the hope is that, you know, the U.S. sets the standard as it has on the field for women's soccer, and now is continuing that standard off the field in the financial arena.
We've been talking about money mostly so far. How about playing conditions, the kind of fields people play on, the kind of logistical support, the equipment they get? I remember sitting down with the family to watch a women's friendly game some years back. The field conditions are so bad, they canceled the game. We got to rewatch the World Cup victory over Japan, which was cool to see again, but yeah, you want to see the live game. Are those kind of conditions part of the story here?
Yeah, and things like the field playing on artificial turf, that was phased out several years ago. So that wasn't really part of this deal. I mean, it is. They're not going to play on artificial turf, but the women haven't played on turf in many years. You know, when you talk to Federation people, they'll admit that was a huge mistake, that they would always put the men, or almost always put the men, on grass fields. The women often played on turf, you know, just treated like a second class program. No one wants to play on turf. Sometimes it's necessary, but it was affecting the, you know, the health and welfare of players. And obviously that cancellation, certainly was the low point. You know, this collective bargaining agreement, dictates that teams have, equal backing for staffing, for charter flights, for hotels, for all the, you know, the support systems that go into, funding and backing a world-class program.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Stephen, you said the next step might be FIFA. Now, that's a very different organization. It wasn't that long ago, I think, that the head of FIFA said, you know, maybe cute short skirts or something like that. That's what it's going to take to get attention to the women's game. I mean, how do you is there any sense that that organization is going to loosen up on these things?
Yeah, I mean, things have gotten better with FIFA and how they treat the women's game. You know, you start to see them pay a little more attention to the Women's World Cup. They understand, you know, the market forces here, that people are watching, and if people are watching, they can charge more to sponsors. They understand They're starting to understand the power of women's soccer in certain countries, but certainly it's growing around the world. I mean, FIFA could certainly take the lead and say, hey, you know what? The men's tournament does generate more revenue than the women, but for the good of the game, you know, we're going to give equal prize money to the men and women and, you know, advance the game that way as well. So it's a slow moving organization, but I think there's a little bit of momentum here.
Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Stephen Goff covers soccer for the Washington Post. After a quick break, we're going to continue talking about the story, this equal pay for men and women in U.S. soccer, and hear from a sports columnist. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this story? Are you a fan of soccer, of women's soccer in particular? Are you happy about this news? Women's sports in general, do you think this this change might give them a boost at different levels? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're raising, as I once did, girls who are playing soccer, what do you think this means for them? 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the new collective bargaining agreement between the U.S. women's and men's national soccer teams and the governing organization, the U.S. Soccer Federation. This week, they all reached a deal that would see the women compensated the same as the men. We just heard from a soccer reporter about some of the details. Now we'll hear from a sports columnist. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Nancy Armour is a columnist for USA Today Sports. Nancy, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, you tackled this very question in a recent column. How big a deal is this agreement?
This is huge. You know, the money itself is significant and will make a big difference for the women, a lot of whom have, you know, they've not been able to make a living wage playing soccer professionally. But in terms of the message that it sends and the signal that it gives, it is monumental. It is, as Midge Purse said, it is not appropriate to pay women less than men for doing the same job. And no longer will U.S. soccer do that. And I think that sends a message to people in every industry, in every kind of workforce, that, you know, the days of shortchanging women can and should and will be over.
Do you see this, as someone who covers other sports too, do you see this as something that could spill over not just into soccer, but into other women's sports?
Well, I think it is it's hard to make apples to apples comparisons, mm-hmm. because, you know, U.S. soccer is as Stephen said, it's a federation, it's a nonprofit. You know, it's different than, say, the NBA and the WNBA, which are separate entities. However, I think what this does show is that there is interest in women's sports, that there is a market for it, and that if you pay for it, if you give a women's team the support, both financially and, you know, if you want to call it emotionally, you will get a return on it financially. And I think we are starting to see that in the marketplace already, and I think this is only going to encourage or accelerate that.
Yeah, can you talk about what you've seen in terms of rising sports fan interest in women's sports? I think I saw that the women's national team is at the most viewed soccer game in the United States. Do you see other data points like that?
Yeah, you know, the numbers for every women's sports have been rising dramatically. You know, the year of the pandemic, one thing that was very notable was that viewing of sports was actually down for most of men's sports. And yet the sports that showed an increase in viewership were the WNBA and the NWSL, the two women's professional leagues that were playing during the summer of 2020. You are seeing rising ratings on ESPN and ABC for the NCAA women's tournament. You are seeing rising ratings for the WNBA. The national championships for volleyball, softball, gymnastics all have recorded increases. So clearly, I like to say this, if you give women a platform, there's going to be interest. But for decades and far too long, there just hasn't been this platform for women. And now, fortunately, we are seeing that start to change.
Talking to Nancy Armour, columnist for USA Today Sports, looking at the new agreement in U.S. soccer, paying men and women in the sport equally on the national teams. You can join in with your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call and say that I think it's a terrible idea. I do not think that the women's soccer team and the men's soccer team should be paid equally.
Because?
Because the women's team has been running circles around the men. They've been blowing it out of the water. They should be paid a lot more.
Laura, I wondered if you were going that way.
Laura, thanks for the call. Nancy, what do you think? I mean, in recent years, it's hard to argue. Well, one team's been very successful on the world stage.
You know, and it's, I think that there is something, I don't want to say there's necessarily something to that, but I think there have been a lot of people who've said that. You know, the men didn't even make the World Cup in 2018, whereas the women have won it the last two times. It's, you know, in 2015 and 2019. I also think that was probably a factor in the men getting on board with us, that, you know, you can say that, okay, the men are losing some of their prize money, but you can't lose what you don't have. So they, you know, the women's prize money that they got for 15 and 19 might not be huge, but it still is better than what the men got for 2018, which was nothing. So I think that has created a recognition from the men and from U.S. soccer that, listen, this is good for all of us, that, you know, supporting the women's team, encouraging people to invest in the women's team is only going to benefit both teams. The more money that the women bring in is the more money that the men get too. So there have been people who said, yeah, they should just pay the women more than the men. And just based on performance the last few years, it's hard to argue with that.
Let's go to Paul now in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, you know, you're one of my favorite shows.
Thanks.
So, I wanted to bring something new, but I can't. I go Chicago Sky, and I just wanted to say the same thing, that I think equal is not equal in this case, because if we think of from a good old American capitalistic perspective, you've got the team that's actually, and I don't want to do the give an inch, take a mile, but, you know, take all milestones where we can get them, but it seems to me we're on our way, but the women should be making far more than the men.
Paul.
And that was my point, too.
Gotcha, Paul. Paul agreeing with our first caller. But then, Nancy, also, Paul mentioned the Chicago Sky. You mentioned, yep, you know, the women professional players, the ones who are not necessarily going to be on the national team. Some of them are, some of them aren't. It is not a way to really support yourself playing in women's soccer. The WNBA, we see a lot of players ending up playing overseas in part because of that, including, sadly, Brittany Griner, stuck in Russia, yep, jailed in Russia now. Do you think this national agreement is going to send a message to the pro teams that Paul just mentioned there?
The conversation with the WNBA is tough, because it's also, you know, part of that is that the women play overseas in order to just keep game fresh, because the WNBA season is so short. But yeah, I think this shows the value, you know, that there is worth to women. And I think, like I mentioned, I think we're seeing it, you know, in the rising ratings, in the rising corporate interest, in the interest that, you know, people who are buying teams now, that the values of franchises are rising for in the women's leagues. One thing I will point out is, because of the bonus structure, the way that things go, the women actually technically could make more money, because if you know, the guys, the furthest that they've gotten since 2002 is the round of 16. So that's what, four games at the World Cup. The women have gone to the final. So they are playing more games than the men do. So that is going to allow them to make more money, theoretically. So just pointing that one out. But yeah, I think that this is going to show leagues that they need to step up, that the days of getting by on the cheap or running teams and leagues on the cheap no longer flies. And if they don't get with the program, then they're going to have consequences.
Thanks for that call. We heard from Joel on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, so long as a women's sport generates equal revenue as the men's version does, they should get equal pay. They do in the four major pro tennis tournaments, as women's tennis is very popular. But Joel goes on, the same can't be said for women's professional golf and professional basketball. In short, the market should dictate the compensation of professional athletes. What do you think? Go ahead, Nancy. Yeah.
I will ask Mark then, how much free sport have the men's leagues gotten for 50 years? You can't have this conversation about revenue unless you acknowledge that men have been the default for the better part of a century. You know, the women were not given the opportunity to use the branding and the logo of March Madness until this year. Do you really not think that if they had been able to use this for what, the last 40 years or however long it's been that the men have, that there wouldn't be more interest in that tournament, that it wouldn't be generating maybe the same amounts of money? You know, everything in sports has been set up to benefit men. And so you cannot have these conversations about revenue without acknowledging that women have been put behind the eight ball. I mean, it's expecting them to, you know, hit a home run or get to cross home plate from, you know, starting at bat, whereas the men are starting on third base. You know, it's not the same argument yet. But if you put the resources and the investment into women's sports, then we can have a discussion in 10, 15 years, 20 years, and see where we're at.
Nancy, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That's Nancy Armour, columnist for USA Today Sports. We talked with her and heard from Washington Post soccer reporter Stephen Goff about the new collective bargaining deal this week that ensures the U.S. national women's soccer team will be paid the same as the men. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the U.S. is still struggling with addiction problems. Rural Wisconsin is no exception. Find out how clinics around the state are trying to help people deal with addiction and to prevent it in the first place. We'll invite you to share your own stories as well. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a new report highlights the traumatic impact of the boarding schools many Native American children were forced into for decades. We'll look at the impact on lives and cultures and what it still means today. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up Memorial Day and summer cookout season, they're just around the corner. We get you ready, whether you're the host or you're bringing a dish to pass on this week's edition of Food Friday. Now, the U.S. Department of the Interior released the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative investigative report earlier this May. The 106-page report reveals at least 500 deaths of Native American children forced to attend those schools and the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse they experienced. From 1819 to 1969, the federal government managed 408 boarding schools within 37 states, including some in Wisconsin. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland spoke earlier this month about the report.
As the federal government moved the country west, they also moved to exterminate, eradicate, and assimilate Native Americans, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. The languages, cultures, religions, traditional practices, and even the history of Native communities, all of it was targeted for destruction. Nowhere is that clearer than in the legacy of federal Indian boarding schools.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Did you or someone you know have to go to one of those boarding schools? If so, how did that impact your or their lives? What questions do you have about this long history of Native American children being forced to go to these schools? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Levi Rickard is the founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online, a member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation. Levi, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure, Rob.
Before we dig into this report, can you talk about what these boarding schools were? Because I think for non-natives, the phrase boarding school maybe conjures up, you know, something in England or something like that. What do we mean by these?
And you're exactly right. Here in the United States, even in New England, the boarding schools, typically wealthy people send their children to boarding schools. But these boarding schools were schools set up across the United States, into even into Alaska, when it was just a territory in Native Hawaii, to take children from their homes, Native children from their homes, put them in boarding schools with the intention to assimilate them into American society. And as the report that you mentioned, the 106-page report that came out last week, they clear indication that there was physical, sexual, emotional abuse. And what's really historic about this report is the first time the U.S. government has officially acknowledged this abuse that took place. And as you mentioned, up to 500 deaths. And I wrote an editorial last week that I just feel like it's the tip of the iceberg in terms of the deaths.
Now, I think for people who are not familiar with this story, this report may seem shocking. I'm guessing for a lot of Native Americans, this confirms a lot that people already knew, right?
That's very true. And I talked to one of our staff last week, who she's in her 20s. She's from Boyce Fork up in Minnesota. And I asked her, I said, tell me, as you were coming up,
We're losing our connection with our guest there, Levi Rickert with Native News Online, talking about a new report on Native American boarding schools around the U.S., a new federal report looking at the damage, the harm done. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. This report tracks 150-year history of Native American children being forced into these boarding schools, the damage it's done, and the legacy it leaves today. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll hopefully get that connection back up and rejoin the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a bit, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to get some great advice on foods to bring along to maybe a Memorial Day cookout, maybe a picnic this summer. It's summertime foods to bring and pass a dish and share. You can get started right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what your favorites are, or if you have a question for our guest who is an expert on this kind of stuff. Again, you can head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. And as always with Food Friday, we've got some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Levi Rickert is with us now from Native News Online. We're looking at this new report on the history of boarding schools that Native American children were forced to go into over the course of 150 years, looking at the findings of the report and the significance. Levi, I think we have you back. You were talking about some of the significance of this report, the fact that it was done and it came out. Can you pick up where you left off, please?
Sure. I want to make a point. It was very historic because it's the first time the U.S. government has admitted to the abuse, which included physical, sexual, and emotional abuse, and up to 500 deaths. So, and I think that the death count, 500, many experts believe it's very low, and it's just it's the tip of the iceberg.
What kind of things do we learn about the reasons for the existence of the boarding school? As you mentioned at the outset, the concept here was to assimilate Native American children. What did that mean in practice as far as what was done to, taught to, and forbidden to the children who were sent to these schools?
Well, what happened was there's a lot of abuse. And first of all, the separation from the families is pretty significant. Oftentimes, children from far away as Alaska were sent down to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which is literally thousands of miles away. And the separation really worked to destroy the fabric of American Indian families. And it still lingers to today. And as the Assistant Secretary of the Interior, Brian Newland, said last week, that every Native American, whether they even acknowledge it or even know it, has been negatively impacted by boarding schools. And I know it's true in all of our families.
And this happened, as I mentioned, as recently as 1969. I mean, there are people still alive today who attended these schools, maybe worked at them. And then the report also talks about some of what you were just touching on there, the generational trauma, how that disruption of family life you mentioned echoed through the generations, even for people who maybe didn't attend those schools themselves. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, that's very true. And what happens is these schools and the students really did not get that love that all of us need in that those interpersonal relationships. I have seen grown adults, male and female, who are Native American, cry about how their mother or their grandparents never knew how to love them properly, give them proper hugs, and show them the attention that's really is needed. And when that is stolen from us, that those interpersonal relationships, it continues from one generation to the next. And I think all of us who are really aware of what's going on now as Native Americans, we have to really stop ourselves and really do self-assessments, even within our own families, and say, how can I be a better parent to my children, for instance? Am I showing them the proper love and respect? And I will say this, I come from a real strong Native American family, but my grandmother attended a boarding school, and we look back at some of the things that have happened in our family, and we are acknowledging that maybe this is the result of the boarding school experience that grandma went through.
This report now, it is just a report, but do you see it as a step to try to recognize what happened and find ways to, I don't know what, acknowledge, make amends?
Well, I think first of all, the fact that the government for the first time ever has acknowledged it is pretty significant. Significant to me as a Native American, because the federal government, a lot of times, they just ignored some of our issues. And so I think the fact that Deb Haaland, who happens to be the first American Indian, not just a woman, she's a woman, but first American Indian, Native American, she's of the Pueblo, Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico. The idea that she was in that role, I just don't think that a white male, who typically are the Secretary of the Interior, would have taken it this far, and she's allowed this to proceed. And Brian Newland, who is a friend of mine, because I'm from Michigan, he's from Brimley, Michigan, Bay Mills community up there. They have really taken this beyond what I would think the typical non-Native bureaucrats and officials, in all due respect, would have taken it. And so that is significant. And what I would like to see happen, and Deb Haaland, Secretary of the Interior, is embarking on a Road to Healing tour this year, where she will engage with survivors of boarding schools, and they're going to work further to identify those who have died in boarding schools, where the graves are. And so I think that's just really good step. And I love the word healing, because I think all of us, and I don't care whether you're Native American or what color you are, all of us need healing in our lives, and it's just important. And I like to tell people that healing is a lifelong process. It's not something you can't go to necessarily a church service or a therapy session and think all of your problems in life will be solved overnight. It doesn't happen that way. It's a life process. And this is the generation I think can really make the big difference because of what Deb Haaland is allowing to happen right now.
Levi Rickert is with us, founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online, looking at a new report from the U.S. Department of the Interior, looking at the 150-year history of boarding schools that Native American children were forced to go to, the damage done, and next steps. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to our callers now. Tricia is with us in Black Earth. Tricia, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to confirm from a very different perspective. I am white as wool, and in 1968 got married to a man who was taken into the teacher corps, which was new and sort of like a domestic Peace Corps. And I think there was a bit of an attempt to try and ameliorate some of the damage that was done. We were taught a bit, as much as we could absorb in a few months, about the Navajo culture. And we learned a little bit of the language. And our job was to try and soften some of those sort of brutal.
Tricia, I think we lost you there, but Tricia said that the key year there, 1968, a year before 1969, which the report says is when these ended. What was going on around that time that led to the end of this forced boarding school policy?
Well, whereas I know the report says that, and this really deals with the federal boarding schools, mm-hmm. I know in Michigan, we had one at run by the Catholic Diocese in northern Michigan in Harbor Springs, Holy Childhood, that existed till 1984. So I personally know people who attended that school. So I think as time went on, I think that people did recognize, whereas I mentioned the government's just acknowledging it, but some people really knew some of the abuses that were going on. And so I think that there were people within the systems really trying to eradicate, stop all that and arrest that, because they knew it was having a negative effect on Native Americans. So it's kind of hard for me to really ascertain why it stopped completely. And there are still some boarding schools existing in the United States that tribes are running. And the difference, key differences, and I want the listeners to know this, the key difference is that the tribes are now running them in that, whereas we were deprived of our language, our culture. The tribes, when there are boarding schools, they have language classes, culturals being taught, and there is a resurgence of American culture, American Indian culture throughout Indian country, which I am really, as a Native person, really excited about.
Tricia, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lisa joins us next in Madison. Lisa, hello.
Hi, I was just wondering if the guests could talk more about, I'm wondering how many of these children, I've heard with the boarding schools on the first year or two, when they'd send them home for the summer, the families would realize they're going to come and take my children back. So the families, of course, would try to hide their children or not let them go. And so then these boarding schools, when they would get these children, would, rather than send them home, send them off to basically white families where these children were treated as slave labor. And I wonder how often this happened, you know, how many boarding schools engaged in this practice.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Levi, do we know the scope of resistance trying to keep kids from being forced to send to these schools and what happened in response?
Well, Lisa kind of presented a loaded proposition here. There's different factors, but I'll say this, that the program was known as the outing program. And what they did was, and she's right, they would send them to farms or other places for almost like slave labor. And many of these kids never returned. And some of them, you know, it has been suggested that maybe they were either kidnapped, taken away, maybe they died and nobody knew what happened to them. And that's the travesty of this whole thing, is the idea that these kids were removed from the families, and some of them disappeared forever. And some people's generations later are still wondering what happened to, and in this case, now they'd be their ancestor, their aunt, great aunt, or whatever. And families have had to live with that pain of having lost those children. And as far as Lisa's point about families hiding their children, I know of families here in Michigan that really have, they had codes, and people were coming knocking on the door they did not know. They had code language and say those kids knew to go hide because they didn't want those kids to ever go back to those schools. So it's like I said, it's a very loaded thing, multifaceted proposition here.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Levi, I know in the news recently, Canada, some of the Catholic institutions you mentioned earlier, investigations found similar kinds of horror stories, really. I believe the Pope issued an apology. Are you hoping to see more investigations like that of different kind of schools here in the U.S. to see if what happened in Canada was happening here, too?
Yes, I completely agree with the idea of this investigation to continue to really delve deep. And I think, to me, that's part of the healing process, really identify how bad this was. And as I said earlier, the 500 deaths that they know now, I mean, I know of 227 up in Michigan alone, and then there's like 186 graves, as I recall, down in Carlisle. So, yeah, those together, you're almost at 500 right there. And so I just think it's going to go into thousands. And there are many experts who have been studying boarding schools for decades who suggest that it will go into maybe up to 10,000 students that went missing or lost. And you think about that. These are kids, American Indian, Native American, Alaska Native kids, Hawaiian children that were not able to live their futures. And what a travesty that is, and what a pain, what a stigma it is. It's a dark chapter in American history. And notice I said American history. Mm-hmm.
You have written other pieces recently, Levi, in addition to covering this report, looking at language preservation, restoration, the loss of medicinal traditions and others. Can you talk about your hopes to restore some of what might have been lost as the chains of knowledge were broken in these schools?
Well, and I'm really am excited, as I said, about the resurgence of American Indian culture. And I really like that because I've seen it in my lifetime. And I would really think that a lot of it started with the American Indian movement back in the 1970s and really have triggered. And, you know, with the passing of the 1978 American Indian Freedom of Religion Act that allows American Indians to practice their traditional ceremonial practices, that was really key to helping shift that. And we can embrace our culture, live our culture now. And I would love to see that happen and continue. And it's just so important. The language that was, many of our families, I call it like two or three lost generations because it was stripped from us. We haven't been able to continue that. And language is just that. There again, it's part of that fabric of culture that is just so important. Like there are 22 Spanish-speaking nations in the world. That's what brings them together as Hispanic people, is that language. And so often our language has been stripped from us. And I'm really excited because Congress has passed legislation that says these American Indian kids, Native American kids, they deserve to learn their languages. And that is exciting.
I've talked over the years, Levi, to people doing education in some of the languages, the native languages of Wisconsin, as well as practical arts and skills, canoe making, textile arts, and more. Mm-hmm. Are there projects like that that you've seen that you're particularly excited about that you want to shout out, whether in Michigan or elsewhere around the Midwest?
I would say Michigan has a lot. I know I'm on the advisory council at Grand Valley State University. We're going to have a summer camp. And so it's a two-way street. The kids can come, Native kids can, you know, learn a little more about their culture, but also be acquainted with the idea they can go get their education, which is so critically important. So there's that program, but across the country, there are tribe after tribe, usually have really strong youth groups that they are teaching them how to make ribbon skirts, some of the attire that our children can dance in powwows and celebrate who they are as Native Americans. And I'm just excited about it. And given the fact that we deal with the negative history, that is the positive thing that I'm seeing today.
In just our last minute, Levi, this report from the U.S. Department of the Interior, I don't think anybody views it as a last step. Briefly, what are you hoping to see next?
I'm hoping to see a better number of the deaths and further acknowledgement. I would like to see how the U.S. government, in some cases, I think it's quite necessary to implement more mental health counseling, mental health services on Indian reservations. It's just, to me, so many of our people still suffer because of what happened with the boarding schools. And I think that Congress needs to acknowledge it. The administration needs to acknowledge it, that more money is needed to heal.
Levi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Levi Rickert, founder, publisher, and editor of Native News Online, member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation. He joined us today to talk about the new Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative investigative report looking at the 150-year history of these federally mandated boarding schools for Native American children. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're getting ready to cook out for Memorial Day and this summer and getting some great dishes to bring along and maybe pass at potlucks, picnics, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.